afternoon. Quick check on the Friday forecast. Sunny, windy, and seasonal. Today's high 56, winds up to 25 miles per hour. Right now, nice morning. Wind west at 15, sunny and 44 degrees in both Kenosha and Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. In part one of today's program, you'll be hearing from the author of a beautiful book about fly fishing. In part two, an archival interview that explores one of the most visited websites on the internet, Wikipedia. Here's part one. And we are beginning today's morning show by exploring a world that you may or may not know very much about. I, for one, am very much a newcomer to the world of fly fishing, and I am so excited that I have learned so much about it from taking in hand an absolutely wonderful new book called The Believer, A Year in the Fly Fishing Life. It's written by David Coggins, who has written for the New York Times, the bestseller Men in Style, and a previous book called The Optimist, which also explores his experience as a fly fisherman. And in this latest book, we, in a sense, follow him as he goes around the world pursuing this great love of his and experiencing all kinds of intriguing things along the way. The writing of David Coggins has appeared in the Financial Times, Esquire, and in his newsletter, The Contender. This new book is published by Scribner, again titled The Believer, A Year in the Fly Fishing Life. David Coggins, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks so much. It's great to be with you.
I really, really love this book. And let me hasten to add, I love this book, even though I am myself not at all a fisherman. In fact, I'm pretty sure I've not held a fishing pole in my life since I was maybe in fifth grade. But I just found myself just absolutely fascinated, just captivated by this book. And I think a lot of people, even with little or no particular interest in fly fishing, will still find this perhaps a really interesting and enjoyable book. Was that your intention? I'm guessing it was.
Well, yes. I mean, I try to communicate some of the my pleasures of the sport, and I think a lot of those pleasures are universal. I think that I actually learned to fish in Wisconsin on a lake there. I'm from Minneapolis. And so I started fishing in a more conventional way and then moved on to fly fishing, which is a little more rarefied. But I think that I think we can all connect to some sort of obsession, maybe something that takes over our life a little bit, even if we don't fish.
Absolutely. And one of the things you write about in such intriguing fashion is how there is sometimes a real friction with other responsibilities in life, especially when we get to a certain point in life where we might have a spouse or we might have children or professional responsibilities, and the demands of something like fly fishing can really be kind of a complication. We'll talk about that in just a second. Could you just expand a little on what you just mentioned in passing, namely that some of your earliest memorable fishing experiences occurred in the great state of Wisconsin?
Yeah, I love Wisconsin. So I grew up in Minneapolis, and my family had a cabin 2 hours east in southwest Wisconsin. And so I would spend a lot of my summers there. And as I get older, that area still has a very big part in my life. I drive like a crazy person every year from New York, which takes a few days to get back to the cabin. And I really look forward to that every year. And I still have a deep connection to that place and kind of in Chippewa County. And I learned how to fish from two older men who are friends of my grandfather's who lived on that lake, too. So part of the way I came to the sport, first, I just kind of taught myself regular fishing. But when I wanted to get better, I would go out with Carter and Dave. When I finally got the courage to go with them, I was a little intimidated by my grandfather's friends. who seemed so old to me. I'm embarrassed to say now that they're not much older than I am now. But that's how I got into the sport, and it was a really wonderful thing. There are many wonderful rivers in Wisconsin and lakes, of course, and a lot of them aren't used very much, which is kind of a surprise. If you can put a canoe in somewhere, you're not going to get a lot of company, because everyone's got their big motorboats. So that's a little bit of a secret about your great state.
So we probably should not go any further in this conversation without you offering some clarification on what exactly we mean by fly fishing versus more regular or conventional fishing. And also, in a sense, what makes it, you know, in a sense, an elevated level of what we think of as fishing.
Well, without going crazy about it, what most people fish is what we call conventional tackle. And so the weight of the lure when you cast carries that lure, that spinner or whatever, to wherever you're aiming. And it's not that complicated to cast. A fly rod, which is usually longer, the fly has no weight. So you kind of have that rhythmic back and forth motion, sort of meditative. And then you kind of, if you do it correctly, it takes a while to learn, it kind of unfurls this little fly onto the surface that usually floats down in the current toward a trout. That's the classical way of doing it, which was basically invented in England a few centuries ago. And it's not the easiest way to catch a fish. So anyone who fly fishes is already making some sort of decision in their life that they want to do something in a more artful way and a more difficult way. And that means usually those of us who fish are a little bit eccentric or connect to this method. And I think one of the great things about fly fishing is that you have to work and improve it over the years. And so you might suffer a little bit, probably like downhill skiing or something like that, or sailing. And then you come to learn the technique better. And then that makes, when you finally succeed, hopefully it makes it a little more satisfying. At least I've found that to be the case. You can also, you don't just have to do it for trout. In Wisconsin, I did it for smallmouth bass, which is a wonderful thing to do and something I would recommend. A lot of people have said, you can really get into the sport anywhere. It doesn't have to be in England or on these, or Montana, which is where we sort of associate the sport with. You can do it in almost every state in America.
And there's something kind of intriguing about the title of your previous book, The Optimist, and this current book, The Believer. And and explain why you're using the term sport to describe fly fishing.
Well, traditionally we were called, you have a guide, a fishing guide, and the person who goes out with a guide is called a sport. And I think it is still a sporting pursuit in a more traditional sense. It's not really a competition, but we view it. I think it's more of a distinction that it's not something you have to do. It's an element of play is involved. I'm not competitive at all when I fish, but I do think you're involved in some sort of a way that you succeed or fail, some metric that you set for yourself, which often changes over time, as a matter of fact. I think when you start fishing, at first fly fishing, you just want to catch one fish, you'll be happy. Then as you get sort of better at it, you want to catch it in a little more complicated way. And that I think there is an element of sport to that.
We're speaking with David Coggins about his newest book, The Believer, A Year in the Fly Fishing Life. Your very first sentence is this: I'm halfway through my life. And you go on to say, this bracing metric puts time in perspective, a clear, well-defined before giving way to a symmetrical, even poignant after. The long view no longer looks so long. I'm 45, or I was when I began this book. Tell us more about that particular perspective that you have written your book, The Believer, at this roughly midpoint in your life, and in a sense, the way in which that has pretty powerfully shaped your perspective on the stories that you recount here.
Well, my book sounds a lot better when you read it. I have to say, you've got a great voice. It's very persuasive. Well, I was thinking, you know, during COVID, you kind of reassess where you are in your life. And when you can't travel, you can't live in Manhattan, you couldn't really leave your apartment. And so you start thinking about how you want to spend time, which I think also makes sense as you get older and you assess what matters to you and what are the kind of domestic things that you know for sure are important, or professional things that are vital to you, but also what's maybe a passion you have that isn't, you know, the real part of your life, the thing that makes you responsible and, you know, earns you money and makes you part of society. And I think those things are important too. So my idea, at least when I couldn't travel, was what if I could travel for 1 year? What would I do? How would I spend my time? And of course, these halfway through my life, I also joke. I mean, I've been saying that for years, so it's not a technical number, but it feels sort of halfway. So in this, the book details this past year, actually it was 2 years ago now, where I went to kind of places I'd always wanted to go and enjoyed it very much, but also reassessed, you know, what does fishing mean in my life, and what does it mean? What is it taking me away from, and what is it bringing to me? And I think that balance is, I hope, something people can connect to. I think we all have some sort of passion that we brings us outside of ourselves, takes us away from our cell phone and, you know, the social media endless hum. And I think it's good. Fishing is good that way. It takes you kind of outside of time. And if you go away from home and travel to do it, it takes you even more outside of, you know, kind of the regular rhythms of your life. And so that's something that I'm fascinated with and honestly struggle with. I think when you go on a fishing trip, if you're leaving someone behind, might be considered a little bit selfish behavior. But also you want to continue to do these things you care about and kind of strike the right balance. Mm. And that's what I'm trying to do.
Right. And I do love what you say about time, and that comes up time and time again in your book. At one point in the introduction, you say, "So I've been thinking about time. When you have a lot of time, it's not something you think much about. When you realize there's less time, things unfortunately start to move more quickly." And you go on to say fishing has a specific relationship to time, and that to fish properly, you need time. And of course, that's what makes it, you know, in a sense, kind of an intriguing pursuit, is that demand, and especially that demand of your time at this point in your life, when there are other things that are, in a sense, pulling on your time.
That's exactly the case. And I think in some sense, I, you know, when you're young and you get obsessed with something, and I don't know, you listen to one band over and over, you maybe even go on road trips, or you just do something crazy, that seems not such an unusual thing to do, because you're in your 20s and you don't have sort of responsibilities. And I think I had this idea that maybe I would kind of break the fever of fishing, like maybe I'm too old to be doing these trips, or you got to find a friend to do it with often, and maybe he can't come, or he's got his own responsibilities, or he gets his hip replaced or something. And I think I want to know, if could I give up fishing, or if I did it enough, could I still be happy in other ways? And I think the answer is, of course, yes, like you can. But it's there's no clean answer, or it kind of shifts depending on what you do. And I think when you do associate, time does feel different as you get older. I mean, you know, my beard's gray, and now a bunch of things I never thought would happen to me, or I just associated with my dad or my granddad, are now happening to me. And it happens to all of us, of course. And I think fishing is sort of a lens that I can examine aging and time through.
Right. Yeah. At one point you say angling can become a full life and a way to measure a life. The seasons, the years, the people you've fished with, those who patiently taught you, who have moved on to the trout stream in the sky. And now, to your surprise, you are the one who teaches other people. So in a sense, your life as a fisherman also helps you, in a sense, make sense of the own arc of your life. Something else in your introduction I want to be sure to ask you about is this beautiful little turn of phrase. You write, "While loved ones must be briefed on your long-term plans, fishing remains, to a large degree, a secret life." Explain what you mean by that.
Well, you know, when you're passionate about something, often people, or if I just talk to you about fishing, you kind of want to know in the broad strokes how a trip went, or how a day went. You just, did you catch fish or not? But for people who are very obsessed about it, we're going to ask a lot more questions. You know, what were the conditions like? What flies did you use? In what way did you catch these fish? And so that's what I mean by a secret life, that you become It's sort of like if the basic home cook, you just like you throw something on the grill, but you know someone else is like making a more complicated recipe and seasoning something, or there's a lot more technique at stake that only a better chef will know about. And I think this idea of a secret life is like, there's something irrational about fishing in a way, and I think I like that about it, and I like people who share that. I don't think everything should be, you know, we're kind of in an age where everything can be measured and quantified, analytics and metrics and everything else, and fishing is sort of the antidote to that. And I think that when you go and fish in a place away from home, you're getting out of that intensity of modern life, and I think that's a little bit why it's secret in that sense.
Yeah, I love that that notion. I think it's really intriguing and also entirely true. And there are certain occupations where you really have to be on the inside to understand what the experience is all about. One thing that you touch on, both in the introduction and at several points during the book, is the sobering, troubling matter of climate change. And at one point you write, more and more being on the water means confronting a changing global climate that affects every place fish live, and always for the worse. That's one reason my fishing trips are charged with a different meaning. They don't express the reckless opportunity they did when I was younger. Now they feel more fleeting, marked, however faintly, with desperation. Each trip might be the last of its kind. That's really interesting to think about, and I'm really glad that you bring this up, because it's an important matter both within the realm of fly fishing and, of course, in all of our lives in every single respect.
Yeah, you know, it's tough. When you're younger, or even before there was so much awareness of what was going on, like my previous book, The Optimist, I was just sort of celebrating what I loved about fishing, and I didn't touch on climate change as much. But I think anytime anybody, whether it's a farmer or an angler or someone who's outside a lot, there's so many things that change, so many things that we observe, and it's not good. And if you talk to any fishing guide, someone who's on the water 150 days a year or 200, they can tell you anecdotally what's going on, and the water is getting warmer, and it affects the migrations of the great fish like Atlantic salmon and steelhead trout, which are going down. And that's part of being on the water, and I think anyone who fishes seriously has to be a conservationist, and it's our responsibility, for those of us who love the sport or just love the natural world, to try to, you know, contribute and however we can to preserving the great waters around America and the world. And it's not something to be in denial about, unfortunately, but it's something to acknowledge and to try to do our part.
We're speaking with David Coggins about his new book, The Believer, A Year in the Fly Fishing Life. Your book chronicles your journeys to all kinds of different places, including Spain, Scotland, Norway, Belize, and more. When you're writing about preparations for your trip to Argentina, which is the first voyage we experience with you, you write these words: packing for a fishing trip still excites me. I hope that never changes. Anticipation is inextricably tied to angling. It's the motivation behind every cast. Being well prepared builds confidence in the heart and soul of a man. I love that, and in a sense, that is so much a part of, you know, the actual act of fishing of any kind, especially fly fishing, but that even before you're actually on the water, even just in the act of packing for one of these trips, that's also, in a sense, a really important part of the experience.
Yes, yes. I always try to convince people that it's not just when you're on the water. It's as soon as you know you're going to go fishing and you start looking at weather reports in Argentina, even if they're going to be out of date, and you start imagining what you're going to bring, and you talk to your friends, what's he going to bring? Do you have this? I send friends links to things on eBay that we should try to get, and you were, I still do it. I'm already doing it for the trips this summer. And then you start packing and you know, it's sort of like getting ready for camp when you're a little boy or something. And you start this, you know, you're so official and you think you're going to have control over the process. And then of course, by the time you get there, something has changed and you don't have the fly you need or your waterproof jacket disappointing you. And so, but I love all of that. I think that you want to embrace that. Before I go on a trip, I try to have like a meeting with my friends and we like get together and celebrate the trip and, you know, look forward to it. And I think all of that is part of this experience. And I think when you expand something, it makes it's more generous and more enjoyable. And I try to do that before one of these big trips.
Right. And of course, one of the things you tie together with the packing that you do is when you say, I still need the illusion of control. And of course, that's one thing when you are doing something like fishing, you can never be in complete control, however much you might want to
right.
be. I wanted to ask you just a couple other quick things. In your chapter about your fishing expedition to beautiful Belize, you talk about pursuing what is a rare accomplishment for fly fishers, and it's something known as the Grand Slam. Can you just briefly describe the Grand Slam and the experience of pursuing this?
I hesitate to do this because I don't want to set people down the wrong path and they'll almost certainly be disappointed, but that's part of the sport sometimes.
Yeah.
A grand slam is catching three saltwater fish, the bonefish, the tarpon, and the permit on the same day. And those fish, they often live in close proximity to one another, but they're very different. Tarpon is quite large. Permit can be large enough, and a bonefish is smaller, but it's very hard to catch all of them. And once you, I didn't even know this thing existed until a few years ago or 10 years ago, and then someone just kind of invented it. There's no reason that this should be a thing. But then, of course, once it is a thing, then you want to do it, and it leads you to do all sorts of crazy. You say it doesn't matter to you, but then it kind of does. And this is, you know, these are the kind of odd rationalizations that anglers make all the time. And the more we fish, the more crazy ideas get into our head. I think one of the themes of the book is that this isn't you. I kind of expect to arrive at some kind of philosophical zen-like moment. And that certainly happens from time to time. But just as often, all sorts of craziness is going on, and things I said I wouldn't do, I end up doing, or things I promised wouldn't make me angry will, you know, disappoint me somehow. And that's, honestly, I embrace that at this point, and I think I like other people who embrace that too. I think it's human in a way, and every one of these metrics, you want to catch a 20-pound salmon, or you want to succeed at the Grand Slam, and you know they'll happen or they won't happen, but you've got to have a sense of humor about it at some level,
for sure. Maybe it's because I'm half Norwegian, I especially enjoyed your chapter about your trip to Norway and all that you wrote about you know, the various locales you visited. And at one point you mentioned the friendly friction between Sweden and Norway, and it is in this chapter that you are talking about your pursuit of the salmon. And you say at one point, to understand salmon is to be in awe. Tell us what's behind those intriguing words.
Well, the Atlantic salmon is really one of the great animals, and the more you know, the more I admire them anyway. I mean, this is a fish that's born in a river, and at a certain point, it swims out to the ocean. So right there, it's a fish that can go back and forth from freshwater to saltwater, and it kind of transforms as it does that. Once it's in the ocean, it eats a lot, but it also avoids all sorts of things that want to eat it, seals and whales and other things. And it, as it's in the ocean, it gets bigger and stronger. It's a beautiful silver fish. And then it, at a certain point, it comes back to the mouth. It might also, I should say, swim thousands of miles, immense distances. It's really out there. And then it comes back to the mouth of the river where it was born. And the salmon will amass there from all over the ocean, the same salmon from the same river. And then at a certain point, they will start to swim up the river. And they will swim up when there's enough water, and they all seem to know. And they will go back to exactly the same stretch of the river where they were born, and they will spawn and have continue their line and have new salmon. And it's an extraordinary migration, and it's one of the really tremendous things. And if you want to catch one, you want to go to the stretch of the river when they're there, and that is hard to predict. You many times when you're fishing, you try to catch a fish and it just doesn't agree with you, but you know it's there, if it's a trout or something. In the case of salmon, you can fish for hours and days and there will be no fish there. But that's why people who are try to catch Atlantic salmon are even more irrational than the rest of the fly anglers. But it's just to be part of that is an amazing thing. And I think there's a lot, the numbers of Atlantic salmon are going down, about talking about climate change and just how we manage our waters. And that's something that's particularly tragic. But the Atlantic salmon itself is really one of the great, been around way longer than humans have. And they've been doing this it's almost ancient. And that's something that, speaking of time, that's very inspiring. And sometimes these animals, especially in Norway, it's an incredibly beautiful place. That's part of the culture there, and you feel that when you're there, and that's a wonderful thing. And it's, fishing can be a way to learn about a place and learn about the world. I want to be open to that.
Right. And we certainly meet some interesting people along the way in your book.
Yeah.
In a minute or so, describe what you typically do when you catch a fish. I mean,
that's a good question. I mean, so I caught quite a few fish at this point. I should also say, for people who haven't fly fished before, that it's called light tackle. So you can't just reel the fish in. It will break. You have to kind of fight the fish in a way that the fish gets tired, and then you bring it in slowly. So usually when the fish is at hand, as we say, it's tired. And I almost every place I fish, you put the fish back, either by rule or just by principle, catch and release. So I don't even take the fish out of the water if I don't have to. I've already intruded on its life enough. I just try to unhook it. Maybe I'll take a video of it swimming away, which is very beautiful. But I'm with it for a moment. Sometimes it sits by your feet because it's just catching its energy again. And that's usually a special moment. And to watch it swim away is a great thing. And and sometimes you feel like you've triumphed, or sometimes you feel like maybe what you thought would be a triumph is you wanted something and you didn't quite get it, or you thought it was going to bring you some sort of glory that maybe doesn't exist. And so it's usually a poignant moment.
Hmm. I love that. I love this moment, too, when you write, "Our sport by design is not streamlined for success. Fly fishing is like writing longhand rather than typing. It's personal and takes longer. The efficiency gurus do not appreciate this sporting balance. Fly fishing isn't supposed to be easy. It's supposed to be hard, or at least hard enough. And that specific difficulty is how we, in our small way, aim for some higher, if not achievement, at least a higher ideal." The book again is The Believer, A Year in the Fly Fishing Life, published by Scribner and the author David Coggins. David Coggins, I hope you can tell how much I loved your book, and I know lots of people will enjoy exploring it as I did. Thank you so much for your time, and very, very best wishes to you.
Thank you. Really appreciate it. Great to talk.
You're listening to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. For part two of today's program, we're going into the Morning Show archives for an interview recorded and initially broadcast way back in 2008. It's a book that concerns something that at the time was a relatively new part of the internet and now seems like an indispensable staple that so many of us use on a nearly daily basis: Wikipedia. Well, we are going to be talking about yet another in an interesting series of book called collectively The Missing Manuals. And today we talk about Wikipedia, The Missing Manual, the book that should have been in the box. And it is a book which helps us understand how Wikipedia, one of the most frequently visited sites in all of the internet, functions. And it's rapidly, amazingly rapid rise to prominence, and the way in which this incredible collaborative enterprise has worked so well and so much better than any of the skeptics were predicting. And John Broughton has a deep involvement with Wikipedia. He is one of the busiest of its registered editors, with more than 15,000 edits to his credit at the time that he wrote this book. And we'll be talking with him about Wikipedia and what it means for the rest of the internet and what might be ahead. And I look forward to talking with him about this interesting book, which, by the way, is published by O'Reilly. Wikipedia, The Missing Manual. John Broughton, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you for the invitation.
Explain just a little further, for my benefit as well as our listeners, exactly what your connection with Wikipedia is and the work that you've done for Wikipedia.
Well, I'm just one of tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of editors. Some of them registered. A lot of them, you don't even have to register, have done edits. But I started working a little over a year ago on an index for editors to keep track of all of the policies and guidelines and reference pages and instructional pages and tutorials and tools and so on. And as the index got larger and larger, I came to two conclusions. One was that editors really needed, particularly new editors or people just starting out who found they were interested in editing Wikipedia, really could benefit from a step-by-step book that walked them through from the very beginning of starting editing to some of the more complicated issues, such as when you get into a disagreement with another editor about content. And I also realized that because I created this index, at the time I asked O'Reilly about their interest in a book, there was over 1,000 entries. There's now over 3,000 entries. But I realized as I had created this index, I had actually written an index for the book, because I sorted the entries into categories as well as alphabetically. So that's how I got deeply involved in Wikipedia.
Explain to us actually, really briefly, I think most of our listeners will certainly know what Wikipedia is. Give us the 45-second summary for any of our listeners who do not know what Wikipedia is.
It's the largest online encyclopedia on the web. It's actually in more than 200 languages. So the book I wrote is about the English Wikipedia, not about all the others. And its distinction is it is the encyclopedia that anyone can edit. So if someone is reading an article and sees a mistake or sees something that could be added, all they need to do is click the Edit This Page tab at the top of the page, or preferably the edit link for the section they're interested in improving, because it's always better to edit a section than the whole article. And then they can go in and add that information or delete incorrect information. In the best of all worlds, they would actually say how they had, where they'd found that. They'd cite a source. And that's part of what the book's about, is to encourage people and tell them how to do that, because unfortunately a lot of people, when they add information, it may be right, it may be wrong, but they don't say where they got it.
You called yourself a registered editor of Wikipedia. Tell us what that distinction means.
It's not very hard. You click on create a login, I believe, that's linked, that's on the upper right-hand corner of the page, and you basically pick a username, an editor name, and I think you have to prove that you're not an automated program by there's an image up there. You have to type what the image is. And that's about it. You don't have to give an email address. You don't have to pay. There are a lot of benefits to it. One of them is that it keeps all your edits together. So if you're interested in a particular article that you've edited, you can go and see what you've done to it. It's much harder if you're not registered. You can monitor articles to see when they change and then go in and take a look and see whether the change was good or not. So registered editor and anonymous IP editor, those are the two different categories. Not very hard to become a registered editor. It's been done more than 7 million times on the English Wikipedia. But that's the difference.
You know, it's interesting, as you were describing this process, which I had some acquaintance with already, I'm reminded of the experience of reading the NPR Guide to Classical Music, or how listeners should build a classical library, mm-hmm. the title, something like that, and I interviewed the author for this program, and as I read this book, I remember a fairly significant error jumping out at me about the opera singer Kirsten Flagstead and what opera was her farewell vehicle at the Met or something like that. But I absolutely knew without a doubt that he was wrong, that this was a simple error, but an important one. And I don't know that I exactly felt it at the time. And now as I think about Wikipedia, I feel this sort of latent frustration all these months later that you can pick up a book, a normal book off the shelf, see a terrible error, and essentially not be able to do anything about it.
Right.
And the beauty of Wikipedia, the way it is set up, is that as you read something, if you find something that in fact is not at all right, there is a means by which you can do something about it.
Instant gratification. It's again helpful to put a source in because you're not only interested in improving the article, you're interested in your improvement actually sticking. And if you cite a source, then there's a whole lot better chance that it's going to stay, because removing sourced information is considered highly improper unless the source isn't a very good one. You're not, for example, supposed to cite a blog or a discussion forum, for example, as a source. But yes, the gratification aspects, or if you're really interested in a topic, maybe you even built a web page about it, and you look at Wikipedia and it's not as good, well, now you could share that information by actually improving the article, and probably a lot more people there's a good chance a lot more people are going to find Wikipedia than your website. But even if that's not true, there's going to be more people because they're reading Wikipedia and your website. So yeah, I think that feature, the fact that there's no editorial review, no approvals, no screening, those sort of things, really is one of the big underlying factors in Wikipedia's success, is that people really like to see what they did there and visible for everybody.
Hmm. Of course, that is also the heart and soul of what fueled the criticism of skeptics.
Yes.
In your introduction, you say, why expect quality articles if everyone, the university professor and the 12-year-old middle school student, has equal editing rights? And indeed, we do hear of certain, thankfully, isolated cases in which some things have gone on the pages of Wikipedia that should not have been there in the first place. I mean, be they honest mistakes or even pranks and I guess you could call it sort of cyber vandalism.
Mm-hmm.
Just tell us a little bit about how much Wikipedia has experienced this sort of thing since being created in 2001.
Well, it's certainly an issue. There are things called wiki projects where a bunch of editors get together and work on a particular set of topics. And there's a little internal newsletter that comes out every week within the Wikipedia community that interviewed somebody involved, a couple people I think involved in the professional wrestling wiki project. These are people who are really into professional wrestling, and so they go and they fix up and improve articles and work together. And they mentioned a couple times in the interview that they spend a lot of time reverting vandalism in professional wrestling articles. If they didn't spend that much time, they could actually have more time to fix it. So yes, there is a problem with vandalism, a less of a problem, I think, with pranks or people deliberately trying to put bad information in. And Wikipedia has various levels of defenses. There are software bots, they call them, that actually pick out the most egregious vandalism and revert it. Those sort of things last about 20 seconds or so on a page before they're fixed. The software makes it very easy to reverse an edit by another editor. That's a bad fact when you come into edit wars where people are reversing each other's edits, but it's generally a good thing. And people monitor articles. People monitor every edit that's made, or at least try to monitor every edit that's made. So the bottom line is that the quality's not bad, the quality's far from perfect, and it's important to be skeptical about what you read.
Well, and if you're writing a research paper, Wikipedia needs to be used, in a sense, sparingly, maybe to initially explore a topic, but certainly should not be treated as the same thing as much more substantial and trustworthy material.
Right, and that's one of the reasons why you can measure the quality of an article by the number of footnotes and the number of sources cited, which are also the ones that you would follow if you want to get something you could both cite and read in more detail. Because Wikipedia, the goal of Wikipedia is not to capture all of the information in the universe. It's just to provide generally a higher level overview. I use a rule of thumb, I'm not sure how closely I follow it, that you don't want to ever take more than 5 or 10% of an article from a newspaper or magazine and put it into Wikipedia, because besides the copyright issues involved, you're also getting down into the details that really get in the way of a reader getting a better sense of kind of the overview. So it is an encyclopedia. I mean, it's certainly, the model out there is Encyclopedia Britannica. If every article in Wikipedia were that quality, the world, it would be an incredible thing.
We had kind of a funny real-life experience with Wikipedia just last night, right after my wife killed a centipede, which appeared under our dog's food dish in the kitchen. She kind of wondered then, for some reason, do centipedes have 100 legs?
Okay.
I mean, is that what we call them, centipedes? And so, of course, what I do is go right to Wikipedia, and didn't know what to expect under the heading of centipede. I did not expect to find as extensive and detailed an article as I did, with all kinds of photographs and this and that. And unfortunately, it was all but impossible to glean from all of that information the answer to my fairly basic question. And in a sense, although depending on why you're looking up centipedes in the first place, that really detailed article might be helpful. But, you know, in my case, I would have welcomed it being a much shorter, simpler article. It would have been easier to navigate in that respect.
Right. And so I'm looking at it right now here, and there really isn't any discussion. And it would be nice in the first opening lead set, they call the lead section, to talk about where that name came from. But you're right about natural science articles, species, that sort of thing. There are some phenomenal articles. People love to take pictures here, and the pictures are, free. It doesn't cost you anything to take a picture of a centipede, as opposed to, say, it's very difficult to take a picture of a celebrity and put it in an article. Those are kind of neat. And the only thing I can suggest to readers like you who get frustrated about what seems to be obviously missing information is to click the tab. Tab at the top of an article called Discussion, and going over to the Discussion page, and at the very top, I won't walk you through all the details, there's a little plus sign, which means add a new section. And if you click on that and then basically type in your question, say, hey, the article doesn't cover this and I'd really like to, could somebody add that? There's actually a very good chance somebody will, because people who are interested in the article and monitor it also monitor that Discussion page. But, sometimes people who are so close to a subject, they really, really know the subject, they don't think about the more basic questions that a reader would have. And eventually that changes. If somebody puts in the answer, it'll probably stick. But it is curious, yes.
We're speaking with John Broughton about his book, Wikipedia, The Missing Manual, the book that should have been in the box. So really, although we could read this book and have some understanding of how best to use Wikipedia, more than anything, your book seems to offer some really good help for somebody who would like to participate in Wikipedia. and do some of this editing. One of your suggestions is for people to seek out something which is called the sandbox. Tell us about that.
The sandbox, and in the left-hand side, there's a search box, and the book talks about typing in shortcuts. So the shortcut for the sandbox, all in capitals, though it's probably a little bit able to handle varieties of that. Anyway, if you type in WP colon sand, all one word, and type go, you end up in the sandbox. And the sandbox is a place where anybody can edit. If you're a registered editor, you can also create your own personal sandbox. It's just an extra page. And it's a place to practice. It's a place to type things and see how things work, so that you don't do that in actual real live articles, which is not a good thing. And the book does, in fact, start out in the first chapter by a couple of examples of editing the sandbox. And then after you've registered, and that's the third chapter, it shows you how to create your own personal page, your own personal sandbox. And that's a place to practice. How do you add an image to an article? How do you put a category on an article? How do you do a footnote? Those sort of things. So it's a great place to practice, where you're not going to hurt anything, and nobody's going to come along and scold you for having done something wrong. One of the nice things about Wikipedia.
Right. Now, of course, it is possible to do things wrong once you do them for real, and you devote a few pages to something that you call edit conflicts. Mm-hmm. What sorts of conflicts tend to emerge when someone edits an article for Wikipedia?
Well, part of it depends upon the level of passion that that editors bring to the article, and part of it depends upon... Well, that's actually the most common thing. If you make a mistake, somebody will fix it. They'll usually leave you a nice note or a comment in the edit summary of the edit that fixed your edit. And one of the things about Wikipedia that's a philosophy is all you're trying to do is improve an article. You're never trying to get it perfect. If you do something that improves it, even though part of it's a mistake, somebody comes along and fixes that. Edit conflicts are more troublesome. I mean, I was reading watching a CNN video about the edit conflicts. The editorial disputes over the candidates, presidential candidates, Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, John McCain, and there are just lots of people who heard something, read something, they think it's a fact, it's not, it's an opinion, and they want that in the article. And there are a number of ways to deal with that. If you're not into high volume one, you basically go to the discussion page and you talk it out. You work on trying to get consensus. You acknowledge that if the other person has a good source, that information probably does go into the article, and you question perhaps how much goes in, but some goes in. If they don't have a good source, then you explain that, point to the guidelines and policy. And although at any given time there's probably 100 or 200 hotspots in Wikipedia where there are vigorous discussions going on, generally these things get resolved. People read the rules and they follow the rules, and if they don't, eventually they get asked to leave or made to leave. So this is one of the puzzles about Wikipedia, is how do you manage to get consensus, rough consensus, when in fact you're never going to see the person you're disputing an article with face-to-face. They may be in an entirely different country. They certainly will come into it with different opinions. And the amazing thing about it, again, is that these almost always get resolved without having to call in the big sticks, but there are a few around if necessary.
John Broughton is the author of Wikipedia, The Missing Manual, published by O'Reilly. This interview, recorded back in 2008 at the time of the publication of this book, a book which came out at a time when Wikipedia was still a relatively new addition to the Internet. I'm Gregory Berg. Tomorrow on the podcast version of the morning show, an interview that I recorded with Dr. Tom Noor some years ago. It's the last opportunity that I had to speak with Dr. Tom Noor, who passed away on April 7th, and we will reshare that interesting interview in which he looks back on health scares and epidemics in American history. That's tomorrow on the Saturday podcast version of The Morning Show. Look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg, available on all